the Chase Bank, dealing with the sins, dealing with the fascism of that place, perpetrated upon us by the highest paid Wall Street executive, Jamie Dimon, $35 million annually that we know of. God knows about the hidden income. Sue me for saying that, Jamie. Come on. I'm kidding. No, I'm not. We will sing in this bank that finances police violence. We will sing in this bank that finances gentrification through its mortgage programs. We will sing in this bank more than anything. We will sing in this bank for just being violent against life. And I'm thinking, of course, Earthalluia. I'm thinking of the contribution to the toxicity in the atmosphere by JPMorgan Chase. How can't you think about that? The nitrous oxide, the methane, the CO2, the fluorinated gases, the greenhouse gases, heating up this planet. Every time you pick up the newspaper, if your own windows aren't being blown out and your roof being ripped off, you can read about it in the paper. Somebody else is in pain and the suffering and lost livelihoods and just... we are in the sixth extinction, the apocalypse. It is accelerating, and Chase is making money from it. And we will keep singing. Somebody give me an Earthalluia here today.
Earthalluia.
Well, yes, hi, this is Rocker T passing through. You know, when I'm in Portland, checking for 90.7 cable, for real. This is the One Love Jam down with a DJ like Ja Will, for real. Now my selector!
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hand him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are artists Shelley Sokolowski and Vovo. They're here talking about the new show at Portland State University called Weaving Data, which is on now through April 29th. First, I'm going to talk to Shelley Sokolowski. She's an adjunct professor in the art department at PSU. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus by Zoom, Shelley.
Thank you for having me, Joseph.
This show, Weaving Data, it's about the kind of overlap between looms, you know, weaving, and then computing. And the kind of gist of it is computers are kind of high-tech and privileged technology. Weaving has been doing something kind of similar for thousands of years. The people who do the work are sort of minimized and not lionized like people in high tech. It's kind of a huge thesis for a show, but I should say the show is absolutely beautiful, and there's so much fiber art to get your teeth into in this show. Two floors of work, it's quite amazing. So how did you come to hear about the show and be included?
Well, I was invited by Theo and Nancy. They came to my studio for a visit after they had already conceived the concept of the show.
Theo used to run Up For, the digital only gallery.
Yes, and frankly, it's not surprising that they would come up with this type of theme, in that weaving has always been marginalized as long as I've been working in the field. And I've been working in the weaving field since the 70s.
So everyone except one, I think, in this show is using this new kind of high-tech loom, which takes digital imagery and you hand weave, but it's kind of sets it up for you. What's it called?
Yes, this loom is called Thread Counter Number 2. It's the second iteration of this loom that's really been around only for the last decade or two. It operates by reading Photoshop, and it has pistons, and it allows the pistons and the vacuum pump allow the pistons to raise.
But is it like a cheat? You just get your picture of Che Guevara and feed it in and then spit a blank?
It sure could be, but no. The weaver has to assign weave structures. So you have to build your image in Photoshop, and then you deconstruct the image, and you have to understand weaving in order to be able to assign weave structures that will read appropriately.
The other point that the show kind of rubric makes is that the Jacquard loom used punch cards, so did the first computers.
That's right. Well, in 1801 is when the Jacquard loom was first discovered, if you will. It was fashioned after the automated machines of the time, player pianos, for example.
So your work in the show, I mean, we're going to call it the drone series because you took photos taken by drones of like ice fields and glaciers and things like that. And then you turn them into these amazing silvery gray and white tapestries that hang on the wall, that they're not pressed flat, you know, they have their own kind of shape. Tell us about the first one. As you come in, they're downstairs in the basement, and the first one on the right, Ursa Major.
These tapestries, I call them tapestries. I mean, technically, they're not considered official tapestries because those would be pre-industrial types of weaving. But in the current language, we call them tapestries. So I was interested in artificial intelligence and surveillance. And it's interesting because I weave on an analog loom also. So in the digital work, I'm very interested in using the language of the digital to manifest something in the material world. And I take stills from moving drone imagery, and I play with them in historical textile surface design patterns and morph them and then come up with a design that I then feed into the loom and assign those weave structures. And I'm really interested in very fine detail. You've got 105 warp threads. Those are the threads running up and down to the inch, to the 1 inch. And then the metal thread is running horizontally in those. And they almost look like drawings, almost like charcoal drawings. They're so detailed. And so Ursa Major is actually a drone image taken over Mount Shasta.
And it does have that Shrouded Turin kind of feel, right? Because they're symmetrical, you know. I think they're symmetrical down the center.
They are. And so I wanted them to exude a very calm quality, even though they're shrouds. They're spiritual in some way. They're reverent in some way of the land, which is just taking a snapshot in time, which we know by today is not the same as it was yesterday. And so they're acting as memorials, shrouds, sort of an honoring of the moment in time, if you will. I'm very interested in playing with the histories of textiles and how it's been marginalized all these years in the camps of, for example, painting or, for example, sculpture. Now, a weaving is both painting and sculpture at the same time, yet it's not at all. And interestingly, it's always been marginalized for as long as I can remember, even in the industrial area. If you want to think about the labor that goes in and the labor is being marginalized, I mount these on stretch linen. I mount them as canvases, even though I'm interested in having their edges stay raw because they are a textile as opposed to stretching them.
You have another one, which is very different because it has a lot of color in it. It's Blood Moon is the short title. It has a red moon, the sort of oval. The top half of the rectangle is pink. The bottom half is gold. And then there's a big black oval written kind of pink. In the yellow, I presume that's maybe a lake or the reflection, but you tell me. And then there are a couple of stripes at the bottom.
It became a lake as I started to put things together. Originally, these are drone images over the Arctic. It's the ice melt, the sheets, glacial sheets melting. And the red blood moon is, you'll see that it has a lot of like floats. We call them floats. It's where the areas are not woven. And so they like fringe, they hang, they suspend with the gravity. And there are some interesting lines that you'll see at the bottom of those. I was playing with the loom and having the loom respond to me. I would stop the loom in mid-weave and I would randomly pick a spot to start weaving again. So it started, I was drawing, if you will, with the loom, and it created these sort of linear, they remind me of electromagnetic waves. The drawing became, the weaving became realized as I was working on it.
Do you mean like when you put a magnet down and iron filings and you tap the ground and they form into, you know, loops around the magnet?
Exactly. And so I am thinking about the electromagnetic fields as I'm working. I'm thinking about vibrational waves and so forth as I'm working on all of these mm-hmm. pieces.
Does a work like that about the melting Arctic have a message?
They're really treated more as shrouds. They're really treated more as memorials for this moment in time. There's no particular message other than sorrow, other than look where we are.
Okay.
It's a mapping of information at this moment.
Right. And then the another one, which is just to the left of the one with the fringe. What's that called?
That's called Phoenix. And it's actually hovering over the Hindu Kush Mountains in Afghanistan, which is a real vortex for mining minerals. And of course, it is political in a covert type of way because we know who can get in there and mine. And so it was a memorial to that idea of that landscape and of the current political situation in that landscape.
But it's super abstract. I mean, you wouldn't know that by looking at it. It could be, you know, folds of cabbage leaves or human flesh. What was the idea of, like, making it abstract?
Yes, of course. And I'm thinking about geomorphology. I'm thinking about evolution. I'm thinking about nothing being static and everything being connected. And so as I'm playing with the patterning that I was discussing earlier with textile patterning and the historic architectural patterning, I'm excited by taking these images and then changing them and altering them in some way as an indication of the altering landscape, but also as an indication of everything changes. Everything's changing all the time. It becomes something else. So I love that. I love that play of what is that? Let's imagine what that is. And you don't really know until you get up very close and maybe even read the title. And then you can see exactly what it is, the mountain range.
What you said earlier about, you know, painting and sculpture, you mean in the art world, they're considered higher than fabric arts or tapestry,
yes,
weaving?
Yes.
In the sense that they're taken more seriously or they command higher prices, the artists are treated differently.
All of the above, yes, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I first got interested in weaving, it was during the second wave feminist movement, and I was in art school, and I specifically chose textiles as a way to distance myself from the machismo of this other world, not knowing at the time that I was setting myself up for that road. But it does make sense. A lot of the second wave feminists were choosing that language to work with that material as a rebuttal. And so we find ourselves today in a very exciting moment where all the conflation of museums and the art world and so forth now are opening up to these, to this movement, to this language. And young students are flocking to weaving now. So it's really mm-hmm. an exciting time.
What about the very short link between the art world and the sort of mass-produced, cute fabric, you know, things you find in a home store?
Right. I mean, that is another potential reason for the marginalization, because it's so closely linked to the domestic, it's so closely linked to mass production. And again, textiles has such a history in pre-industrial, post-industrial language that it feeds this other, if you will. But yes, there is that link. Nonetheless, we are working within that history. And so some of the work that we do is in response to that history all the time.
Just in a few sentences, if you were telling someone to come and see this show, what would you say it does differently when it comes to showing off weaving and fiber arts?
Well, I think this particular show is really exciting in that it has a variety of media in the show. Sound, we have movie, video, we have hand woven, we have analog. And it's all coming from the same place of information storage and textiles as the storage of information, just like the quipu that's lying there in as an element of the show. A quipu is a pre-Columbian form of record keeping. So all of the works in the show are about record keeping. It's actually downstairs, and it's this they're long strings that have knots in them. And the knots in pre-Columbian history, there was a quipu keeper in every village, and the knots represented either monetary information or some sort of historic information that would be kept by the quipu keeper. It would be a record of the village. So all of the work in the show is intentionally storage for some sort of information.
Great. Well, it's a fascinating show. It's the kind of thing I need to go back and see again, because everything is so detailed, and the technology is different, and the context is really different from what I'm used to. So I hope people give it a go. It's up on Broadway, PSU, in the Jordan Schnitzer Museum. My guest this week is installation artist Vovo. They are talking about Weaving Data, a show of modern textiles, which is on now at the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art at Portland State University through April 29th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Vovo. Your piece is one big black and white...
You could call it a tapestry, sure.
Tapestry, yeah. It's an image. It's very big and bold, and you get to see both sides. You can walk behind it. Above it is a speaker with a 30-minute audio track. But when you look at the piece, it looks like a big flowing river. On one side, there's a kind of checkerboard pattern. It could be factory windows. It could be something. On top of that are small images, almost like clip art. Yeah, a megaphone, a gun, a protest banner. That's the left side. The right side has these white circles with images within them. I think that's feet, a torso, like a wounded torso, coffins. It's this one big complicated image that you've rendered in worsted wool. Is that what you said?
So the 30-minute documentary is kind of audible from the dome above the piece. And that's took me about 9 months to research that. It's kind of loosely based on testimonial around the strike in 1912 in Lawrence, Massachusetts, which was textile workers who were protesting their conditions, and they were including children workers from the age of 8 and up. And they were led by immigrants and immigrant women, and they had a really specific anarchist model of organizing. There were, you know, small representative groups that then represented all the different languages spoken and all the different mini groups who then had a say in how the strike would be, I guess, led. As a strike, it eventually got the attention of the president's wife, and she brought more awareness to it, especially because there were children who were involved in these really terrible working conditions. So they won some of their demands, if not all of the demands, and that winning of those workers' strike set a precedent for industrial labor struggle in the United States from that moment on. So mm-hmm. It's just a really important strike. But the reason I made the documentary in the first place was because I was approached about this show, and, you know, I was told that it was about technology or fabric making or textile making or weaving, and that the curators would really welcome a critique of the technology. And for me, my personal touch point is that my mum and my grandma are both people who have had personal injury. My grandmother actually passed away from working in these factories that make fabric for, you know, wide consumer products, clothing and blankets and such. And they both worked in Lawrence, Massachusetts, which is where the strike happened. So in the audio documentary is also an interview with my mum and also my sister, including many other interviews as well. And then the weaving I did kind of right at the tail end, after I compiled all of the audio and the interviews and the kind of research, I drew out some themes from what people had said. And then I drew a triptych, I guess, and made the tapestry out of those things. So the body parts you see are actually in reference to all the different injuries that all the workers described either having happened to them or their family members. That's that. And then the machines on the far right are the different machines that still exist today that people are still using to make the fabrics that we all wear in our like consumer clothing that we buy. And the machines are still kind of embody the hazards that they embodied 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there isn't, you know, a lot of change from the threats and also the low wages that textile workers in the States still are being paid, especially in the same location. And there's a strike that's really celebrated, you know, in speaking to people who were employed in the last 10, 20 years. They're still facing the same struggle and they're getting paid a pittance for making really high-end clothing that is sold for a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you're correct that the weaving does feature one of the factory buildings where the strike occurred.
Is this factory still in use? I would assume everything was unbolted and moved to like South America or Vietnam or something.
So I would say it's a continuous history in this location of several mills. So there's Everett Mills is where the strike occurred, but it was spread out to kind of a wider workers' condition, right? So like it involved more than just the people that worked at Everett Mills. And then those mills have had generations of emptying out and moving to the south, to South Carolina, North Carolina. But this, you know, this town has had a recession, you would call it, post-industrial slump, but then it's still an incredibly strongly immigrant-led, immigrant worker city. So it has the same characteristics, and the things coming out of there industrially are still textiles and clothing. And there's still a lot of big brands that make shoes and clothing in the same set of buildings. The river in the middle is called the Merrimack River, and that's the water that used to power the mills. So the answer is yes, and it's been cycles of industry that's operating and then and not operating. There was the Southwick factories that closed down in the last 10 years. But if you kind of dive in, it's, you know, a very quick Google, you can kind of see the huge amount of industry that's gone through that area. And the reason it's woven with worsted wool is because Lawrence was the world's biggest supplier of worsted wool at the time of the strike.
That was the kind of thick wool that was used in blankets and heavy clothing, is that right?
Yeah.
How did you settle upon the kind of texture that you use here? I can see sort of almost like a grid pattern of the wool itself, and that contrasts with the river, which is this organic form.
I wanted it to be crude because the wool itself is a pretty crude material. I normally work in really bright colors as well, so this was kind of me trying to capture some kind of pre-depression era, like, you know, the grimness of a strike or the conditions around a strike. So I purposefully used monochrome. It's gray, like a gray blue, a white, and cream and a black. But I also tried to use yarn that I had purchased in that area from the mills. I was trying to use material from the mills that still exist that produce wool there. So I started with the material first. I saw that it was crude, so I thought I'll play a little bit with like crude motifs in a lot of rugs, like Moroccan rugs and other more traditional rugs. And I knew this show would have a lot of very exacting, very fine detail considering the technology that the other artists use. So I purposely was trying to play with like, how crude can I get this? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to play with legibility intentionally because it'll start to become illegible. But that's kind of the vernacular of traditional rug making, I would say, of that kind of, or you can almost not tell what the object is, or intentionally using machines and using, like you say, less organic shapes like industrial building, industrial machines, almost having them, yeah, incomprehensible, and playing with the idea of those motifs that are usually like an animal or something a little more organic than an industrial machine.
It kind of looks like a Fall album cover, you know, my favorite band, The Fall. You put on the right side, the little images are in these white circles on pretty much solid black. But on the other side, they're superimposed over the factory window grid. So they're harder to read. Mm-hmm. The outlines are harder to discern. Why did you use that spotlight technique?
I think, like, again, I'm not really a trained visual artist, so I use really naive, almost comic kind of style depiction of storytelling. So for me, I was like, literally on the backdrop of this Everett Mills was this, all the mechanisms of this strike, and the mechanisms were the workers utilizing what power that they had, but then the police, there was a really large state restriction or repression of this strike, and the actual dominant narrative until 1980 was that the strike was wrong, and the narrative only shifted in the 1980s. So I was trying to show a visual narrative of the things that people did. So the equation, when you look at it, try to look at it somewhat objectively, is there's people power and workers against a state force that of excessive violence, and two people were murdered actually during the protests. So it's an attempt to show something without necessarily giving my full thesis on it, even though my politics are pretty clear.
And then you show the back of it, right? People can walk around the back. What's the difference with the back?
Well, most of the image is pretty clear, and actually some of the image is more clear, but in reverse colors in mm-hmm. the back. There are some like back of the weaving mistakes and loose threads and things that I purposely always leave in there intentionally. But for weavers, I think it's interesting to see basically what does a image look like if it's weaved off the warp versus what it looks like when it's weaved off the weft. And you can see that there's kind of almost better definition on the back for some of the images. So there's some like weaver Easter eggs, I would say that's mainly kind of the point of the back being visible. Mm-hmm. But also for people who aren't weavers, I think I wanted them to see, even if it's really messy, I usually do show the back of my work.
Mm-hmm. Does this object have another purpose? Like, would it end up being a blanket or some kind of thing, you know, that you would use?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is my first weaving on this particular loom that's in my possession. So it's, for me, I'm still testing the difference between making a rug and making something else. I think I've in the past I've made a lot of blankets. I've been doing that since I was a teenager. But I think something like this, I would probably put a back on it and either have as a wall hanging. This specifically is an art object, so it would be a wall hanging. But in the future, I would make something similar, but back it as a rug.
Do you think it would have more power as a usable object, you know, with a backing, being on the floor or being used on a couch to keep someone warm, than it would hanging in a museum or an art gallery wall?
Yeah, good question. I think that in the past, that's my dog. In the past, I've purposely made utilitarian objects because coming from a family that's made a living off making fabric and making things and for minimum wage, I did always equate making things with, there has to be a use to it. And only in recent years, I'd say in the last 2 years or 3 years, I've stepped into what if I wasn't from an immigrant background? What if I wasn't from a worker background? What would it, if I was from a middle-class background, would I be taking up a little more space as an artist? And what does it mean for me not to just push myself into a corner and say everything I have to do has to be useful to somebody? But what if it just was an object that took up space that was maybe nice to look at, maybe not, but had something to say and it could live on its own? So that's my exploration as an artist and trying to be an artist that makes things that, for me, this is a, you know, a summary of the interviews, and it does I think it has some stuff to say, if not equal to other visual art pieces that have things to say. So it's almost a resistance to trying to think of it as a utilitarian piece, I would say.
Yeah, how does it make you feel to not be doing the work that your mother and grandmother did and to be in this sort of art world?
Yeah, I mean, that's the point, right, for me, is they didn't choose to do that work. They did that work because it was the only thing available to them given their limited language skills and the community and network they were in. So that was what was presented to them over and over again, and it was backbreaking, literally, work. And so for me, and I think this is the conundrum of any person who's like derived from a working class background, is how do you, maybe step away from the guilt, maybe step away from the messaging that you have of like, you have to be useful and you have to work full time and you have to slog. And if you're not slogging, then you're not working hard enough. But then not only that, I'm trying to use this newfound voice or platform to then also speak to the experience of the working class.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. One of my guests this week is Vovo, an installation artist who is talking about weaving data, which is on at the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art at Portland State University through April 29th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus by Zoom, Bobo.
Thank you.
Andy Wawo looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Wawo, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all.
Estás escuchando KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 7 de febrero del 2023.